What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I'm your host, Katie Helper, joined by
Gabe Pacheco.
We are the Katie Helper Show. You can hear the Katie Helper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI.org 99.5 FM.
Or find us on SoundCloud.
iTunes, Patreon.
Dude, give us the money on Patreon.
Give us your money. Show us the money. Give us your money. Yeah. So we don't have to do ads for, you know, evil companies.
Yeah.
Whatever. Just give us some money. Throw us some bones. Some clamshells.
Shekels.
Clam shekels. Guys, give us your money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really easy.
It's so easy. You just go to patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Just put in a credit card. Yeah. You can link to whatever stuff. $5 a month for bonus content. I don't know if you realize how little that is. That is like, you could comb this, like, you could just walk around, I think, and find pennies on the street. Or you don't have to go to that extreme. That's a little time.
You buy yourself a metal detector. And you start combing the beaches.
How much is a metal detector? I always wonder why
you'll recoup the money that you spent on that metal detector in no time.
In no time. You know what we should do is we should give out a metal detector at our next live taping. We should have a raffle. We should do raffles.
On today's episode, I speak to Christine Ahn, the founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, which is an organization for peace in Korea and women's leadership in peace building. Then I do a little bit of a role reversal and I play you an interview that I did where I was the person being asked questions. I spoke to Emma Bigland from the Young Turks Politics. So Emma interviewed me about some issues, including Israel and Trump's placement of children in tender age shelters.
We will be doing a live taping of the Katie Helper Show on June 30th at Caveat in New York City. That's 21A Clinton Street. And you can go to caveat.nyc to get tickets and get them for a discounted price if you go now. You can use the promo code KHALPERINSIDER. That's KHALPERINSIDER. Again, that's KHALPERINSIDER. And our special guest will be none other than Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank, of course, is the author of Listen Liberal or Whatever Happens to the Party of the People and What's the Matter with Kansas. He writes for places like Harper's, The Guardian, and he is the founder of The Baffler magazine. And Thomas Frank has a brand spanking new book coming out called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. And it's a collection of his writings. See you there, June 30th, 7 p.m. at Caveat at 21 Clinton Street in Manhattan with our special guest, Thomas Frank.
Donald Trump met with Kim Jong-un. And this is like, you know, we should have a segment called like This Week in Liberals Who Want the World to Blow Up in a Nuclear Armageddon. I don't understand. Like, we see this with Putin. People are like, Donald Trump is a dangerous sociopathic monster who
Cheeto Mussolini.
Cheeto Mussolini.
That's the a favorite term by the hackish.
The hackish, still with her ish, still with her ests. And at the same time, he needs to be more aggressive and combative with Vladimir Putin, who is a nuclear armed what? So like they think he's evil but not stupid, right? They think Donald Trump and I think people with liberal brain rot, which we'll call LBR, right? They have this idea that Trump and Putin are like the moral equivalents, except that Putin's not an idiot and Trump is.
Right, because Putin was the head of the KGB.
KGB, yeah.
Yes.
So, again, that still doesn't explain what they want him to do or why they want him to be more combative with this guy. Don't you want them not to be at war? I know I sound like a broken record, but it's like so ridiculous.
The best case scenario is that he's able to keep us on peaceable terms with these other superpowers.
Right.
Or rogue states.
Yeah.
He's meeting with Kim.
Yeah, there was President
Special K.
Special K. So President on Tuesday, June 12th, President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un concluded an extraordinary nuclear summit.
We're very proud of what took place today. I think our whole relationship with North Korea and the Korean Peninsula is it's going to be a very much different situation than it has in the past.
With the U.S. president pledging unspecified security guarantees to the North, and Kim recommitting to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Overnight, after a historic handshake and then this pat on the back, President Trump just moments ago trumpeting his biggest deal yet.
It is right there. It's within our reach. It's going to be there. It's going to happen.
The president saying in an all-night high-stakes summit, the U.S. and Kim Jong-un agreed to
complete denuclearization. That's the big thing.
The president also announcing an end to what he called war games, joint U.S. and South Korean military exercises in the region, labeling them provocative.
Wow. This is like this is everything that Superman wanted in Quest for Peace.
Yeah. And now we now know that what liberals, centrist liberals want is at odds with what Superman wants. They are Lark Luthor. What's his name?
It's Lex Lorth Luthers. Lex Luthor.
Lex Luthor. So people are just, again, freaking out.
No U.S. president has ever agreed to meet with a North Korean dictator before. They have sought this for decades. Kim Jong-un has wanted this for years. His father wanted it before him. His grandfather wanted it before him. All U.S. presidents have been asked. All U.S. presidents has considered it, at least to a certain degree. None of them have said yes. Why did this U.S. president agree to this meeting? Why give North Korea a one-on-one, in-person summit with the American president?
Yeah, Trump announced he will be freezing U.S. military war games with its ally, South Korea.
They're upset.
South Korea's war games with the United States, as President Trump called them, are not war games at all, but a necessary set of defensive exercises undertaken in the shadow of an aggressive adversary.
Right. I saw people on Facebook upset that he's speaking with a tyrant.
Yeah.
Even worse, Trump signaled that he would like to end the American troop presence in South Korea.
The North Korean dictator and the North Korean government appear to have not promised change of any kind in their nuclear program or in any other policy. Literally, they gave up nothing. They promised nothing. In exchange for that generous offer, President Trump gave North Korea this royal wedding-style summit in which North Korea was billed as a nation equal in stature to the United States, and the North Korean dictator was billed as an international leader equal in stature to the president of the United States.
You know, but you can't change the fact that he's a tyrant. Don't we want? We want the open. We just want to have open channels of communication.
You know, he should be like, I'm not going to talk to you unless you do XYZ, and he won't do XYZ, and then we just won't be talking to them. I mean, what's funny is that the people mad at Trump for like talking to this guy are the same people who defended Obama when conservatives were mad at Obama for saying he would talk to Iran or North Korea.
Would you, as president, meet with the leaders of a country like North Korea? Obama extraordinarily said, I'd meet with him.
Senator Obama made his intentions crystal clear on the campaign trail.
I will meet not just with our friends, but with our enemies.
President Obama likes talking to dictators.
He would meet with some of these madmen without any preconditions.
Obama is bowing and scraping before dictators.
It literally is, you just swap out Obama and Trump, right? If you're a lib. And by lib, we don't mean our friends who voted for Hillary Clinton. We don't mean people who are a little bit to our right, like to the right of me and Gabe. We mean like people who really embrace the line of people who live in areas that voted for Trump deserve to lose their health care. Those type of people.
The cold-hearted.
The cold-hearted. How do we define these liberals?
Yeah, they're you need to have a sharp definition.
Because my mom is like, well, don't say that. What is it? Centrist libs? Like, you know, Max Blumenthal calls them id libs. Is it identity politics liberals or I can't remember what it is, but we're going to work on it. How? It's true because we don't want to alienate people. So we're going to have to figure this out. Listeners, feel free to help us define a term. Centrist is okay. Because
there are people who kind of really appreciate the status quo as it was during the Obama administration and that didn't necessarily see the faults in that status quo, which was untenable. Right. The untenable state that Obamacare was in, the untenable state that we're in with immigration in the U.S., the untenable state that we had with North Korea. The complete inequity that's continuing to grow, this divide between the ultra, ultra wealthy and everyone else.
The haves and the have-nots.
So they're looking back to this halcyon time that was pre-Trump as though that was the utopia and that we were continuing to move forward, you know, without addressing any of these problems.
Right.
And now that Trump's in office, we've suddenly entered this age of Ragnarok. We've suddenly entered this time of extreme, everything's upside down when it's not.
Right.
This is he's a logical progression of everything that came before him.
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. If you weren't aware of, or I'm not going to blame you if you weren't aware of it. If you claim to be informed and you didn't care about or weren't aware of the immigration issues that Obama had, right? The way that he was the deporter in chief, then you can't really talk now. Or people who are like, for the first time ever, I realize that racism and misogyny are real. Like it's been real for a while. Like if you're that out of touch, that you're only realizing it now, that's fine, kind of, but just know that your eyes weren't open before. And you can't cling to the same things that you were clinging to before.
And so I think a lot of the libs that are our, I won't say straw man, because they're, you know, the libs out there that look at Trump as the pinata that we have to keep bashing, rather than looking specifically at the policies that are the problem.
Right.
It doesn't matter who the boss is. The policies are what's the issue.
It's going to be another face on that pinata.
Right.
It's going to be another... What is a pinata? Donkey? Another ant?
Yeah, it's going to be another.
So we got a pin
paper
the tail
mache.
On. Another, yeah, exactly.
Stuffed suit.
Exactly, another stuffed suit. Trump shook his hand.
A handshake for the history books. But who had the upper hand? Body language expert Tanya Ryman says you can learn a lot from all that touchy-feely stuff going on between the two leaders.
There it is, the all-important first handshake. Who wins this battle?
The person who extends their hand first is typically the more powerful. That was Donald Trump. He won this hands down.
The handshake lasted 12 seconds. Notice how President Trump is first to let go and directs Kim to turn to the cameras.
But yeah, so all these people who are furious that Trump shook his hand are the same people who were rightfully mad at conservatives when conservatives slammed Obama for saying he was committed to diplomacy. That's what you want. You don't negotiate with friends. You negotiate with enemies, right? So that's one thing. Second of all, they're making it look like it was unprecedented. So you know Jonathan Capehart? He was the guy who a while ago lied about Bernie Sanders in Chicago. We actually talked about him on the show back in the day, and you know, it was one of many lies that were circling around Sanders at that point. This guy doesn't have a good track record. His husband works for Clinton. but he's a big journalist, and he posted something on Twitter. And with that handshake, President Trump has done something no other president has done: legitimized the brutal dictator of North Korea, the most repressive regime in the world. Okay, so what's annoying about that tweet, which got 20,000 likes and 7,000 retweets, what's annoying about that is that it implies that this is like an unprecedented moment of a United States president like engaging in problematic body language with a repressive dictator.
Like when we're friends with Ariel Sharon.
Oh, Sharon Netanyahu. But these people don't even care about them. Like they would be like, oh no, those guys are, you know, represent
Manuel
democracy.
Noriega.
How about Noriega? How about the
or how
Saudi...
about when we were friends with Saddam Hussein?
Yeah, exactly. There's a photo of Rumsfeld shaking his hand.
Yeah.
Or how about just Obama and George Bush holding hands with the Saudi king?
Yeah. Or every president that we have touching the Saudi orb.
Yeah, exactly. The so to speak, the proverbial Saudi orb. But yeah, I mean, that to me is like, I'm not that surprised that they don't care about that KPAR doesn't care about Pinochet, doesn't consider like Netanyahu, because we know all like we were saying before, like Palestinians just don't count for some reason. But come on, like you got photos of multiple presidents holding hands with the Saudi king. They are like the beheading capital of the world. So that's, you're wrong on that front, K-Part. And then you're wrong also because like, what is the takeaway? You wanted Trump to, everyone's so mad they shook hands. Like I have this fantasy of liberals whose desire it is for Trump to like shake hands with Un by like, but putting one of those buzzers in his hands or something. Like what is it that they want him to do? Like,
well,
those electrifying
if you have an embargo
handshakers?
Against another country, if there's no communication right. with the other country, then you can't influence them with soft power,
right?
Which is this idea that they live in a there are people in the U.S. that live in a fantasy world that somehow democracy is going to spontaneously erupt out of these repressive regimes because they want to have our Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
You know, because they think that we will have trade with them. But there's no, you can't have that if you don't open a conduit.
Right.
Right. A reason that their government is repressive is because they think that we're still at war.
Right.
Which we've never officially ended with North Korea. So having a handshake is a great start to, you know, easing those tensions. And maybe then Kim won't be on his guard.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't get what they wanted him to do, literally, like refuse to shake his hand. Or I do think, what's the thing with the buzzer in it? What is, you know what I'm talking about?
They could do pranks? A pound. They could do a
they
pound.
They could do a pound. Or what's the thing where you like almost, I think that happened in
like a
Hangover,
bully move.
A bully move where you like go to shake someone's hand and then you like bring your hand back.
Yeah. And just, you know, like comb your hair
and
back.
You comb your hair. Like you do a Fonz move. It's like the handshake Fonz. Or you'll appreciate this. I found an image of like the Joker in some movie giving someone a handshake and the other person like melts.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I think we could do a whole music video of like U.S. presidents touching dictators. A nice like mashup.
Kino on dictators.
Kino on dictator. Yeah. Like I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand in the background. I'm very, very excited to be talking to Christine Ahn, who is the founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, Women Mobilizing for Peace in Korea, and Women's Leadership in Peace Building. She's also a mom, a writer, and a peace activist, and she's based in Honolulu. So, Christine, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Katie.
Can you tell us what you are doing right now, what you're getting ready to do, and also what your thoughts are on the summit that just took place?
Well, I'm just packing my suitcase because I'm about to head to South Korea to spend a week going on a peace study tour. Most of the time I'll be spending on Jeju Island, which is off the coast of the Korean Peninsula. And it's the 70th anniversary of a massacre called the April 4th Massacre. And I don't know, up to 80,000 islanders were massacred. It was during a period of U.S. military government in South Korea. Most Americans don't realize this, but Korea was one country. It was divided, actually, by the United States in agreement with the former Soviet Union. And for 3 years, in 1945 to 1948, the U.S. militarily had a military government in South Korea and basically installed in a leader puppet government. And there was massive resistance, obviously, to the U.S. military government, to the division of Korea. And Jeju Island was one of those sites where the islanders, being kind of fiercely sovereign people, rose up, and they were protesting the creation of a vote to create two separate Koreas. And it led to basically a massive crackdown against the protesters. And then there was basically an order from the U.S. military government to launch something that's like a scorched earth campaign. And all the villagers basically were labeled as communists, even though when you go back through the U.S. archives, it was clear that the U.S. knew that it wasn't a communist uprising, but it was more just a nationalist desire and sentiment for the Korean people to not face the division of Korea. So I'm actually going to Jeju to be part of a study tour, and then to actually pick up this important moment where we have two summits behind us. We had the April 27th North and South Korean summit, and then the June 12th summit between the U.S. and the DPRK. And right now is the moment. The peace process is moving forward, and we have to ensure that it is going to include civil society. It will include especially women's peace organizations who have been basically on the front lines for decades, calling for an end of this war, calling for a peace treaty. So I will be gathering with some of the South Korean government and civil society and the foreign community, especially the countries with embassies that have feminist foreign policies, to start to have that conversation. How will women's groups be involved in this peace process?
So can you tell me about how you, your thoughts about the recent summit, the June 12th summit, and your reaction to it, and whether you were surprised to that, and also whether you were surprised to the reactions to the summit? So your reaction to the summit and your reaction to the reactions. I know it's very meta.
I know. Well, I mean, first of all, let's just be honest. It is surreal to see Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un.
Right.
I mean, two leaders that are obviously so detested around the world. But as somebody who has been, trying to make that happen for almost two decades, it was an incredible thing to see a U.S. president with the leader of the North Korean government. And as much as we may have our personal feelings against these two kind of autocratic leaders,
right,
the reality is we are away from last year's fire and fury. We are no longer on the brink of a new Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen a commitment to, begin the process of trust building. Obviously the agreement that was signed between President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un is very thin on details, but I think it is quite significant in the fact that there has never been a U.S. standing president that has met a North Korean leader. And none of the past agreements were actually signed by a North Korean leader or a U.S. president. It has always been negotiated by other representatives of the governments. And so I think that's quite significant. And I think, while there has been so much focus on the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of North Korea. Clearly, that's what the Trump administration said they were going to do and to get done. I still think it's early to completely write that off just because it wasn't in that first agreement. What I think both sides left with was actually security guarantees. And I think this is a very important piece that is missed in the analysis of what that summit was about. On the North Korean side, we heard Donald Trump say that the U.S. was willing to halt its military exercises with South Korea. We saw that announcement yesterday by the South Korean government that they agreed to that. And so we know that that has been a huge factor for North Korea, because contrary to the perception that these are just benign military exercises, they are, in fact, what Donald Trump said. They are provocative. They simulate the invasion of North Korea. They have the term decapitation strikes. They include nuclear bombers. And so this has been a huge issue for North Korea to say, we feel threatened. This is why we need to pursue a nuclear weapon to prevent a regime change, first strike from the U.S. And so from the North Korean side, that was a big gain from their part. And from the U.S. side, North Korea agreed to start to dismantle its missile test site. We know that Donald Trump came into office saying, never will this happen. Never will North Korea be able to strike the U.S. mainland with a long-range missile with a nuclear warhead. And I think this is actually, this is a concrete action towards that. And we know that since last November, North Korea has not tested a missile or a nuclear weapon. Obviously, the Olympics afforded that tremendous window to do that. But we have seen, I think, a huge step towards what both sides want. The U.S. wants CVID. The North Koreans want a peace treaty. This is the step to actually get us there. We have what I think the peace movement has been calling for, which is a freeze. For freeze, North Korea's freezing its nuclear missile program. The U.S. freezes its military exercises. I think this is a huge success. And yet the response from liberal media to Democrats, to the disarmament community, has been so surprising. And I feel like it's this feeling of like anything but Trump. Yeah. And for Koreans, which really, you know, the movements, the peace movements and the leaders have really been the driving force of this Korea peace train. And so to basically throw sand in the gears of this train that's in motion feels so like, where does the left or liberals stand right. in terms of seeing peace? Progress for peace and really the reduction of an arms race that is, you know, potentially the most dangerous region in the world.
Right. Yeah, I was really shocked, even though I know I shouldn't be, but I was shocked by how upset some liberals were about this. It seemed like they were more upset that there was something that Trump could spin as good for him than they would have been if he had failed and we had gone to war.
I know, it makes no sense. I absolutely agree with you. It's a little bit dumbfounding to me that, I mean, to see Senator Tammy Duckworth, for example, introduced a resolution with Chris Murphy saying that we're going to prevent the U.S. troops from coming home and that this is, you know, basically not what our allies in South Korea want. And it's like, hello, are you kidding me? You know, in fact, we know that actually when President Moon, before he came to the United States for the first summit with Donald Trump, he actually sent his senior envoy, Moon Chung-in, who is basically known as the guy that floats kind of in new innovative ideas. And he is the one that said, what about potentially canceling or scaling back the military exercises. He was totally attacked for it, but this is a time that is really long overdue. I mean, why is, I recall, you know, during the Olympics, there was a question that was like, oh my God. Oh, Jonathan Chang of the Wall Street Journal tweeted, oh my God, this is amazing. There are actually North Koreans in South Korea. And then somebody responded back to that. Why is it so normal for 30,000 U.S. troops to be on the Korean Peninsula and not, and so weird for there to be North Koreans in Korea.
Right.
So I feel like, 70 years of division, 70 years of a U.S. military presence in South Korea has just, it's become just what the reality is. And I think that if there is a peace process between North and South Korea, this is a fact. And I feel like, this is a come to Jesus moment for the disarmament community, which I feel I'm at loggerheads oftentimes because they've become technocrats that are so singularly focused on denuclearization when, in fact, you look at SIPRI just released a chart of, who has the greatest number, like who are all the nuclear weapons or nuclear armed states? And North Korea's got like 6 to 20. And like, Russia and China and the United States, these are the giants.
Right.
And why aren't we celebrating this path towards de-escalating tensions, towards disarmament, towards potentially the reduction of, the massive proliferation of U.S. bases around the world? I feel like this is a moment for the peace movement to actually have an honest conversation and for liberals to be challenged by progressives that say, why are we responding in this way?
Right.
And even though we may oppose Trump on every other issue, this is good for Korea, and this is good for Americans. This is good for security.
The
this
planet,
is good
the
for
world.
Reinvesting. Yeah, and this is good for reinvesting in things that actually give us security.
Right. And also, it's not like, I think people honestly don't understand how it actually helps us if we don't have to worry, like the left, liberals, whatever, if anti-Trump people don't have to worry about stuff in like nuclear issues, right, or war issues, then we can focus more on the ripping families apart. Like all these horrible things that Trump is doing, it's not like Trump all of a sudden becomes a good person. I mean, I know this sounds so obvious, but I almost feel like we have to say this because some people think that if we think something that Trump does is good, it means we are like signing on to his other programs. And it kind of couldn't be further from the truth.
I think that's such a great point that you make, Katie, is, why are we are fighting, basically the left and progressives have been like, we've been burnt out and we've been fighting, on every front. And so if this is actually something that the Trump administration is doing that is good, I mean, really it's being driven by South Korea and North Korea. And so why don't we just allow that instead of fighting it and reinvest? I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Into things like that need attention right now. Like the fact that we are putting, children in cages and separating them from their families. Yeah, it's absolutely insane. Yeah.
Do you have, speaking of families, do you have family in Korea?
I do. I have family in South Korea and I feel I have made friends in North Korea.
Yeah.
And, this is one of those things where Korean Americans, I mean, my mom used to say that you were able to take the train from Seoul to Pyongyang. And, that it just was like not an issue because Korea wasn't divided. And so, my father's family is from Chuncheon, which is right near the DMZ. So I have no doubt that somehow in past generations and extended families, I have family that are in North Korea.
And how does your family feel about this? Do you have family that's still there who in South Korea who you've spoken to about this?
I mean, yes, I have really conservative family, actually, Katie. Mm. And they are very supportive of this. And it reflects very much the polls in South Korea. 88% of South Koreans support Moon Jae-in.
Wow.
And what is the leading factor is, even though the economy is in crap, it's the fact that he has engaged with North Korea. He has advanced this diplomacy pro-engagement line. And, the result is actually there were local elections across South Korea last week, and he just killed it. His party just killed it. They won, like, the majority of the governor and local seats that were up for re-election. And I think it's just, he has the mandate from the Korean people across the political spectrum. And it's just a very small minority, 12% you know, this older generation, very hardline neocon,
right,
that, you know, wants to go back to 2017. Whereas, you know, the rest of Koreans are saying, this is good. We don't want to be at war. We want peace. And how about like deciding Korea for Korea?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it just, I don't, people are trying to say that, like, some people are pretending that they're upset for kind of the sake of South Koreans. But it seems like they were very receptive to what happened.
I know. And, you know, this is another point that I feel I've been hearing a lot of criticism is, oh my God, Donald Trump, he didn't bring up human rights.
Right, right.
And,
yeah,
you know, this is really a sore point for me because, yeah, I feel like, you know, for those that are, I mean, we know North Korea is like a authoritarian, brutal, repressive place. And, you know, the way that I see it is we are not going to be able to make a dent,
right,
in North Korean human rights if we don't have a relationship with them. Okay.
Right.
And we know that there has been movements and progress towards improvement of North Korean human rights conditions when there is respectful engagement. For example, on the issue of disability, the UN has succeeded in, you know, moving programs and progress towards improving the human rights of those with disabilities in North Korea. Where we haven't had much progress is where in areas that North Korea feels that their sovereignty is at risk. And so we have to come at it from a very pragmatic approach, which is, first of all, we're not going to be able to move anything unless there is some kind of relationship. And secondly, let's think about how North Korea justifies, the government will justify,
exactly,
the repression, the surveillance, the preventing of the North Koreans from leaving, the massive investment in military in preparation for war because of this ongoing state of war. And so that's what I have been kind of, you know, trying to get through to liberals is if you want to improve human rights, you have to look at it from a prism of peace and engagement and diplomacy. That is what's going to improve it. We know that the head of the World Food Program came back from North Korea just a few weeks ago, and he said if there is a peace agreement, it will drastically improve the conditions for the daily lives of North Koreans. So,
right,
you know, let's try to shift the conversation on human rights into actually a pragmatic approach, not from this, like, I'm holier than thou, and we can't engage with North Korea because that's a brutal dictatorship. And, you know, and again, I always say that is such BS. I mean, the United States is willing to have very close relationships with very brutal regimes.
Saudi Arabia, and Israel.
Saudi Arabia, yeah. Let's not forget what's happening in Israel,
yeah,
right,
of course,
now. I don't really know the long history of U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia, but Americans have no freaking clue that actually the United States in the Korean War, where 4 million people were killed in 3 years from 1950 to 53, that 80% of North Korean cities were leveled.
Right.
I mean, photographers and journalists that were there said basically felt like they were walking on the moon because the only thing that was standing were chimneys.
Wow.
Like that's how
insane.
Brutal. And so think about, you know, the North Korean society and the kind of paranoid siege mentality,
yeah,
that has shaped the modern North Korean government and society today. So we are and that's why I say it is so significant that we are actually in this process of dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea. We shouldn't poo-poo it.
Right.
It is a 68-year-old conflict. This is the longest standing U.S. conflict. We have to celebrate it. We have to ensure that it succeeds because the alternative is terrifying. It is John Bolton. It is,
yes,
the
right,
new U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Harry Harris, the former head of the Pacific Command, who is so hardline on North Korea and China. So we have to be very careful here. And I think that, you know, the left is not really thinking this through when they're really quick to decry the June 12th summit.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And we would love to have you back on again. Christine Ahn. Everyone should follow her on Twitter. Her name, her handle is just Christine Ahn. That's A-H-N is how you spell her last name. Founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ. And we'd love to talk to you when you're back from your travels.
Thanks so much, Katie. Look forward to it.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.
So the Trump administration has officially decided to leave the UN Human Rights Council over its treatment of Israel. So let me break it down for you, give you all the facts, and then we're going to give our thoughts, which I'm sure will be spirited. This is from CNN. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley announced the United States is withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council Tuesday, accusing the body of bias against U.S. ally Israel and a failure to hold human rights abusers accountable. The move, which the Trump administration has threatened for months, came down one day after the office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights slammed the separation of children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border as unconscionable. Speaking from the State Department, where she was joined by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Haley defended the move to withdraw from the council, saying U.S. calls for reform were not heeded. Human rights abusers continue to serve on and be elected to the council, said Haley, listing U.S. grievances with the body. The world's most inhumane regimes continue to escape its scrutiny, and the council continues politicizing scapegoating of countries with positive human rights records in an attempt to distract from the abusers in its ranks. There is a lot to unpack here. Anti-Israel bias, we should just start there. And first of all, Saudi Arabia is on the UN Human Rights Council, so it's not like this is some bastion of progressivism or human rights there, but the reason for the United States leaving is so laughable to me. First of all, Israel has been caught killing protester after protester after protester, peaceful protesters, children, press, wearing vests that clearly say that they are part of the media. And then you hear stories like this about Israel. Recording or taking unauthorized pictures of Israeli soldiers clashing with Palestinians could soon bring criminal charges and penalties if legislation proposed by members of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hawkish coalition is enacted into law. On Sunday, the Israeli government endorsed the proposal, which seeks to criminalize the filming and/or distribution of images and video footage showing certain Israeli military operations if the aim is hurting a soldier's spirit or harming national security. Oh, that good one. A conviction for such crimes could carry prison terms of 5 to 10 years. So we are living in a country where our leaders basically don't think that Israel has done anything wrong. They are steadfast in their support of Israel. I would say civil liberties violations such as this don't even raise an eyebrow when it comes to the Trump administration. And Nikki Haley is often perceived in the media as one of the more reasonable members of the Trump administration.
Adults in the room.
Right, adult in the room. When it comes to Israel, there is no one more irrational and insane than Nikki Haley.
I mean, I think that I like that. What is that thing that they're floating, this law that would make it illegal to take pictures of video or pictures of Israeli soldiers clashing with Palestinians if it
hurts
could,
a soldier's spirit right. or
so
harms national
What I think
security.
Is great about this is that what I'm hoping comes from this is a really kind of a new era of constructive criticism, like positive reinforcement and
right.
feedback. So what if I take a video and I film it and I'm like, hi, Yonatan, I'm Jewish, I can make references like that. Hi, Shlomo, great work with that Palestinian protester. But if you like really use your core more, engage your core more than like when you hit him with your gun, you could have like knocked him a couple more teeth out.
Right.
Then I'm not like harming the security or their spirit because I'm not making the soldier feel dispirited. I'm not demoralizing him.
In fact,
and maybe
you're
that would
increasing
be.
His six-pack.
Exactly. I'm increasing
prowess.
His six-pack, and I'm also increasing national security for Israel. No, I mean, of course, Trump doesn't want this. Trump supports this. He would love to have this here, right?
Right.
Netanyahu and Trump are very similar.
One's way smarter.
Yeah. Oh my God. Netanyahu's. Oh yeah. Well, Netanyahu hides his thuggishness behind a veneer of like civility, and you know he went to Harvard and everything. Donald Trump is just, you know, like, you know, a vulgar businessman, really good, really, really, really great negotiator. But yeah, this is a joke. I mean, Israel's violations of human rights are kind of notorious, and they have their own get out of jail free card, which is that they always claim to be the subject of a double standard. You have people here. I mean, there's this term called PEP, progressive except on Palestine, which refers to people who are progressive on most issues, and we agree with them on most issues. And then when it comes to Israel, all of a sudden they're total right-wing hawks. Who also, you know, they ask this rhetorical question, why Israel? Why are you just talking about Israel? Why aren't you talking about North Korea? Which is one of the dumbest questions ever. And the reason we're talking
North Korea's government.
Yes. Tell me, like, show me the politicians, the U.S. politicians who go back to North Korea, you know, who talk about having family there, go visit their family in North Korea. You know, like Chuck Schumer, okay? Chuck Schumer, one of the leading Democrats, minority speaker, he is minority leader, Senate minority leader. He said that the reason there isn't peace in the Middle East is because Muslims and Palestinians, they don't believe in the Torah.
Right.
This is a theocratic view, okay? Israel is allowed to do whatever it wants, and it faces no consequences. Now, if you want to make a comparison, you don't say, why not? You don't say, what about North Korea? Because North Korea, we constantly vilify. The United States vilifies. I mean, look. We are right now adjusting our diplomatic terms with them, that they're not allies. They're not people. The United States government talks about special relationship with Israel all the time. That in itself makes it appropriate to question their behavior.
I think behavior. I know where you're going with this.
Where
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, if you want to make a comparison, then you say, well, what about Saudi Arabia? And that is true. And we need to talk about Saudi Arabia. Again, the difference is the U.S. government kind of hides Trump less with his nice photo op of the orb. But the U.S. government traditionally doesn't really do the photo ops with Saudi leaders the way it does with Israeli leaders, right? Now, that's an issue. But again, everyone knows that Saudi Arabia is not a democracy. Nobody points to Saudi Arabia as this beacon of democracy the way that they do with Israel. So it's the funding of Israel, the pointing to it as a democracy, our special relationship with it, that really makes it appropriate to say, why is Israel doing this?
But, and Israel may have democratic principles and democratic, you know, they may vote. They may vote for, you know,
some of their population.
But it's only a fraction of the population, and then the rest of it is an apartheid state where they are subjugating an entire class and ethnicity of people, and then we pretend like it doesn't exist, and we pretend like Israel is the one under attack when they are the ones that have all of this military support thrown behind them.
Oh, yeah, they're the underdog, right.
Right, but, like, just because, you know, they have a historical underdog story doesn't mean that's the exact same thing today, and states morph. You know, the United States used to have way better principles than it does now, but it's not the same. Just because you supported, you know, Israel under a different leader doesn't mean that you have to support Netanyahu's Israel and what they're doing now. And that's what bothers me most about leaving the UN Human Rights Council, because, yeah, I know it sounds awful on paper, and just because they criticized our ridiculously cruel policy about separating families at the border, you know, you're going to be a baby and take your toy and run away. It's absurd, and I understand that. But what bothers me even more is the propping up of Israel by this administration, and it's a toxic mix of both pro-Israel donors in the United States, like Sheldon Adelson is at the head of that brigade.
Bakari Sellers' friend.
Oh, lovely. And also these Christian fundamentalists that support Donald Trump, who think that if the Jews return to Israel and that it is their homeland, that they will...
Like 400 of us will survive and the rest of us burn in all for eternity.
Right, and like no one talks about how that is one of the most insane things to drive American foreign policy.
The rapture.
The rapture. And as you said, it's way more widespread than you would think. Even Chuck Schumer embraces some of the tenets of this fantasy land of this book that's thousands of years old and makes no sense in the current day. So it's a mixture of both
and AIPAC,
money,
of course, right.
And APAC too, but I would put them in the money category,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, so you have the individual billionaires like Sheldon Adelson, then you have the institution of APAC, which is the American Israeli Political Action Committee, but yet, right, those two go hand in hand, and they actually really distort what it means to be Jewish in America, because right. they become the face of American Jewry, and that's not representative. They're just the well-funded, politically connected, high-profile ones, but they don't represent what most Jews feel about Israel, especially, I mean, the younger ones. That's really changing. So I agree. I mean, in terms of Schumer, of course, like, Schumer doesn't believe in the rapture. He thinks these people are crazy, but he's fine allying himself with them. And he right. certainly is fine with appealing to the idea. His thing about the Torah is more, you know, the Old Testament, as I guess non-Jews or non-religious people call it. That's because he's just trying to kind of make a cultural, like, affinity, you know, with anti-Muslims and anti-Palestinians, anti-Arabs. He doesn't believe in like, the word of God, but he's certainly fine with a theocratic framing. And basically what that is that's just a kind of racist, Islamophobic kind of, yeah, framing of it that makes them look less than civilized. Like, these aren't real people we're dealing with. These are backwards people right. we're dealing with. They're not people of the book, which, again, is an embarrassing thing to hear a Jewish modern person say.
And it's interesting to talk about this in the context of what's happening along the border, because they really are two sides of the exact same coin. So this is a dehumanization yeah. of brown people just based on different philosophies. One is nationalism in the United States, and the other one is Christian Judeo-Christian values in the Middle East. So that's why they justify dehumanizing Palestinians and you know, Latina people coming over the border, immigrants. And it's why it really is racism and corruption, the two driving forces behind this administration. And that's really where you can boil almost every single yeah. decision down to. We want to talk a little bit about something that was in the news. I actually saw Rachel Maddow breaking down, crying about it. She wasn't talking about Russia this time, because this is an incredibly important topic. Another disturbing wrinkle in the awful, awful border family separation story. This comes out of the Associated Press, breaking news, I guess, as of last night. Trump administration officials have been sending babies and other young children forcibly separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border to at least three tender age shelters in South Texas, the Associated Press has learned. Lawyers and medical providers who have visited the Rio Grande Valley shelters describe playrooms of crying preschool-aged children in crisis. The government also plans to open a fourth shelter to house hundreds of young migrant children in Houston, where city leaders denounced the move Tuesday. Since the White House announced its zero-tolerance policy in early May, more than 2,300 children have been taken from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border, resulting in a new influx of young children requiring government care. So the talking point from the Trump administration, one of the ridiculous ones, they've had a variety of ones, you know, it's not a policy. Actually, it's an Obama-era policy, or we don't know anything about it. They've completely waffled on this because they're liars, is that this is a continuation of President Obama's policy. That's, you know, I just alluded to that. That's incorrect. We like to criticize President Obama when we can, but this isn't true. So this is from PolitiFact. Immigration experts we spoke to said Obama-era policies did lead to some family separations, but only relatively rarely, and nowhere near the rate of the Trump administration. Obama generally refrain from prosecution in cases involving adults who cross the border with their kids, says Peter Margolis, an immigration law and national security law professor at Roger Williams University School of Law. In Trump's case, family separations are a feature, not a bug, of the administration's border policies, says David Fitzgerald, who co-directs the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies. The family separations are not the small-scale collateral consequences of a border policy, but rather a deliberate initiative, he added. So again, I wanted to bring this up because, one, I wanted to talk about what's going on at the border with these tender age care facilities. It's just disgusting. Yeah. And then also, when we as a progressive community should criticize right. the Democrats and President Obama, and when you have to know that the talking point criticizing President Obama is coming from right-wing lies. So, you know, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's not funny. It's interesting that every now and then Trump will say something. I call this woke Trump, and I'm being sarcastic, obviously. I don't. Yeah. Trump isn't woke. But it's like every now and then he'll come out saying something that sounds like he's, you know, criticizing Obama from the left. It's totally disingenuous, right? He did this with Hillary Clinton when he talked about how she, he brought up the super predators line, right? He called Obama the deporter in chief. Now, of course, this guy aspires to be the deporter in chief, Trump, right? So it is funny. Now, as you pointed out, there are times when we should and we have to kind of look at the Democratic policies that inform the current policies. And the truth is, I mean, as the law professor that you quoted made this clear, that the separation of children from their parents in this case is a feature, not a bug, right? And, you know, one of the things that's always different with Trump is that there is a discourse, and for sure, there's a hateful, racist, really scary discourse. I mean, we have the Mexicans are rapists, but then also the infestation lines, which are very, I'm someone who thinks that Holocaust analogies can be overused and they kind of lose their potency. Because they're, you know who else did it? The Nazis. But this really is, the infestation thing really does.
Invaders was another one I saw from a Trump surrogate on CNN.
Yeah.
On Aaron Burnett show.
Yeah. Because the infestation thing, just like the bugs and all the that Nazi imagery about Jews being like that. And of course, this, you know, this is a... this is something that Obama didn't do. Now, we can like hold two thoughts in our heads at the same time, right? We can know that the Democrats have thrown immigrants under the bus and that Obama did deport an unprecedented number of people. But we can also acknowledge that he did not oversee a policy like this, which was just kind of really like turning... I mean, it's basically a... it's turning sadism and child abuse into a policy, is what it is.
Yeah, and then, you know, what's so frustrating is that the Trump administration often banks on the tendency of the media to call things even. So,
The false equivalence.
Well, yeah, the false equivalence. So, you know, they have been critical about him on this policy towards, you know, towards Donald Trump. I completely will give the media credit for that. Right. They've been covering this. But eventually it's going to fade away. And then his... idea that, you know, the idea that he's putting out into the public that, you know, the Obama administration with separated families as well, things will fade away and people will begin to call it even because he has no qualms about spreading misinformation. And some of that does stick. You throw enough of things in the enough mud at a wall and it's going to stick. And that's what scares me about this, is that this policy will get blamed on the Democrats when, there really is no way to feasibly do that.
Yeah, I think that that's actually, one of the most dangerous thing about Trump is that he has a couple of, like, get-out-of-jail-free cards that are always there. One is that his kind of, like, shtick, if you will, is that he's a bad boy, right? So he will never get in trouble for having an affair with anyone, like Stormy Daniels. He will never get in trouble for saying he would grab women by the pussy because his supporters either overtly or covertly like that about him, that he breaks the rules, right?
The family values part.
Yeah, they do. Look, he didn't lose the evangelical support. We know that, right? I mean, we're used to these people being hypocrites, right?
It's a Christian nationalism that's melded.
Yeah. One of the other things he uses is the lack of faith in the media, right? So he really banks on people distrusting the media. So he can say that this is an Obama thing, he can say this is a Democrats thing, and then the evidence isn't there. Well, that's because the media is lying, because we can't trust the media. Right. So you're right about that. I think that what the potential strength of this tragedy is that if the media really does show and expose these families being ripped apart, because this is very stupid politics. It's awful policy, but I actually think it's stupid politics on Trump's part.
And it's by the way, the 66% of Americans supposedly, as of the last polling, are against this policy.
Right. I think this is such a viscerally disgusting thing to watch, to see, read about. I think the, you know, ProPublica released that audio of kids crying, and then you hear these ICE Border Patrol officers laughing, saying in Spanish, like, oh, it's a chorus, referring to the sounds that they're making. I think, honestly, that, like, and thank God that the media is finally talking about something other than Russia.
Yeah.
I mean, if we actually, God forbid, we focus on something that moves people and upsets people, as opposed to the constant Russia, this is really going to get Trump in hot water. This is going to be his undoing. And it's not. So enough. Look, if he can be prosecuted or impeached because of Russia stuff, great. it's not going to help defeat Trumpism, first of all. And I don't even know if it's going to work for Trump as the individual. But this is the type of thing that we need to be organizing around. I mean, these are the types of issues that will reach people who aren't already anti-Trump. I really do think, as much as people like to write off Trump supporters, there are two issues. One is that we need to reach voters who went from Obama to Trump, and then we also need to reach people who just stayed at home. And people who stayed at home, this is something, I think, this along with jobs, this is something that will viscerally get to people and make them want to leave and vote against Trump. Of course, you have to have the other pieces, which is what you're voting for. So you have to have candidates who are running on things besides Trump is evil. But I will say that saying running against Trump saying that he will build a wall is less effective than running against Trump saying, look at the children he separated from his family,
right,
and listen to their
families.
Crying.
Yeah. Like, this could be your child. This could be, you know.
I think people who are anti-immigrant even do not want to see this happen. I mean, of course, some do. And then someone's going to talk about an anecdote they have about their racist neighbor saying, lock them all up. Or, you know, I mean, it's absurd. The idea that this is what you get because you are fleeing. This is basically the punishment you have for being a good parent who wants to save the life of your child is getting separated from your child. Because also, let's not forget, these people are, for the most part, running from fleeing countries where they are facing violence that the U.S. largely caused. I mean, this father who killed himself, we think, in Texas, in McAllen,
yes,
was found dead in a jail at the end of May. He was found dead in a jail after being separated from his wife and son, three-year-old son. They had crossed the border. They're from Honduras. They had fled Honduras after his brother-in-law had been murdered.
Right.
Honduras is, of course, not to be... But whatever, Honduras became the murder capital of the world. It was nicknamed that after this coup that happened, a right-wing coup, which was supported by Hillary Clinton, who denied it was a coup and wouldn't treat it as a coup in terms of funding and political sanctions.
But are any coups actually acknowledged? It's always the same, and especially by the United States government when we fund them. Especially in South America.
No, yeah, that is our lane. This one was more of like a back, like after the fact support as opposed to beforehand. But we definitely, other countries in Central America and in Latin America, the Organization of American States, they wanted to treat this as a coup. They wanted to wait for the president who had been taken out. Not a coup. The president was just, you know, escorted from his home in his pajamas and put on a helicopter, as happens in democracy. Yeah.
So this man was...
Sorry, yeah. This man, this is just an example of, like, we are causing the policies that are creating the violence and destabilization that then leads these people to try to seek safety. And it's not like they're looking for an upgrade, like a better view. These people are, like, looking to live and not be killed. And then we send them back to the violence that they're fleeing, or we traumatize the kids here. And, of course, look, without equating, I think we can, going back to your question, it's very important to do two, you know, walk, chew gum and walk at the same time. We can acknowledge that there is some continuation between other administrations, other politicians, and Trump. Hillary Clinton said she thought that kids should be sent back because she wants to send a powerful message. She said this when she was running.
Right, because deterrence for immigration
exactly.
works. It works every
kids
time.
Kids are the ones who are like, you know what, mom and dad, I'm not going to cross the border because there's, dangerous precedent, dangerous deterrent.
By the way, statistical evidence that deterrence and policies like this don't work.
Right.
And when Trump came into office, immigration was at below net zero, meaning more people were leaving than were coming in. It's a made-up problem and a made-up solution to that problem.
Come out to our live taping June 30th at
Caveat.
At Caveat. And by the way, always use the hashtag Katie Help Show. That's letter K, letter T, HALPSHOW. Tell us if you have any guest suggestions for anything you want us to do segments about. You want us to go and like physically go to a place in New York City? We'll do that.
Yeah, we're here for you.
We're here for you. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, guys. See you next week. Bye.
Bye.
We will be doing a live taping of the Katie Halper Show on June 30th at Caveat in New York City. That's 21A Clinton Street. And you can go to caveat.nyc to get tickets and get them for a discounted price. If you go now, you can use the promo code KHALPERINSIDER. That's KHALPERINSIDER. Again, that's KHALPERINSIDER. And our special guest will be none other than Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank, of course, is the author of Listen Liberal, or whatever happens to the Party of the People and what's the matter with Kansas. He writes for places like Harper's, The Guardian, and he is the founder of The Baffler magazine. And Thomas Frank has a brand spanking new book coming out called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society, and it's a collection of his writings. See you there.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.